Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, Mona, there's been a lot of news circulating that the D.C. Court of Appeals has issued some good news for people that have been dealing with a source of funds.
That's right, Mark. Another great victory by Team IRA. But this is really an important area, because if you deal with EB5, the source of funds is a huge issue. Many, many times an investor can obtain cash through a loan or a gift. Well, mainly let's talk about loans, because this whole decision is about loans. The problem is the investor doesn't have collateral. So we've been fine for so many years until USCIS suddenly decided that they were going to reinterpret the whole CFR and the whole loan and indebtedness issue. And that's where we are today.
And this has really been a pain in your side lately, hasn't it?
It really has. So again, we're so grateful that Team IRA and today John Pratt is here to discuss with us how they went forward and fought against the USCIS dragon.
USCIS Dragon sounds ominous. But you're right, Mona. Today on EB5 Investment Voice, we welcome back John Pratt. John is a partner of Kurzban, Tizell, and Pratt in Coral Gables, Florida. He has a focus in many areas of immigration and nationality law, including corporate immigration matters, employment-based immigration and non-immigrant petitions. But of particular interest and focus for today's episode is his experience with complex employment-based federal court litigation. John, welcome back to EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you, Mona, again for inviting me to the podcast. I'm really happy to be back, and especially, obviously, to discuss the Zhang decision that I think has very profound implications in terms of helping investors and curbing the USCIS abuse of adjudications.
Congratulations, John. The case of Zhang versus USCIS, another great victory by Team IRA.
Yes, no, thank you. We're pretty excited with the correct decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit.
Well, you know what folk are calling IRA, the man, the myth, and the legend.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he's been fighting the government and litigating for several decades now, getting results at every district court, circuit court, including the Supreme Court. So he's really a legend in litigation and a lot in EB5 litigation.
John, this is such a huge decision for anyone who does source of funds work or any kind of EB5 work. This is something that we have been seeing for years now, whether it came from the denials and whether it came from your first victories on onwards. But I feel that there's a lot we need to discuss. So perhaps we could just start off by you giving a little background and history of the whole case.
Correct. Well, let's remember that in 2015, at a stakeholders meeting, basically USCIS took the position that any proceeds from a loan that were obtained to fund the EB-5 investment, if those proceeds from that loan came through an unsecured loan or through assets that were not owned by the investor. So for example, if you got a loan or if your parents got a loan and they secure their own property and then they gave the cash proceeds to the child, or if you had, like in our case, the two plaintiffs.
Which is huge, John, because there are so many EB-5 investors are students.
Correct. Or, for example, you had people like their two plaintiffs in this case that got loans through the companies, their companies. But at the end of the day, obviously, USCIS, in our view, and obviously we succeeded in the district court and the circuit court, was misinterpreting and misapplying or not properly applying the definition of capital and investment in the regulation at 204.6E, based on that shareholder or that stakeholder, I'm sorry, meeting in 2015, they started then denying cases again if the loan proceeds or the funds used to fund the EB-5 came through an unsecured loan or secured by assets that were not directly owned by the investor. Then at a later part in 2015, when these two investors, I-526 petitions were denied, we filed a lawsuit in the district court in Washington, D.C., challenging the USCIS's interpretation of the regulation. And obviously that was the commencement of the litigation. Ultimately, in 2018, the D.C. Circuit Court affirmed and basically held that under the definition of capital, one of the definitions is cash. And then later on, in the laundry list of what is capital, there's the indebtedness. And the district court basically said that the loan proceeds, the cash that the person gets is just simply cash. And that the interpretation that somehow constituted indebtedness was absolutely wrong.
John, what's the difference? Just for our listeners and for anyone who's actually doing EB-5, they may not understand the difference between indebtedness and the loan proceeds in cash.
Correct. And in the decision, the current decision, the Shang decision from the circuit court, they basically on page 9 said the meaning of indebtedness is the condition of being indebted to or in debt, or the extent to which one is indebted, the sum owed, the actual debt. So the bottom line is what the court said, wait a second. Indebtedness, as it's defined under the regulation, is between the NCE and the investor. If I owe money like the investor, what used to happen a long time ago is investors would get a promissory note that they were going to be making certain investments over time. That is indebtedness. And if you have that type of indebtedness as your capital contribution in EB-5, then it has to be secured by your own assets equal to the amount of the indebtedness. The court basically said, wait a second, that's not the definition of cash. Cash is just money in the form of coin or ready money. And they used actually the English dictionary to find these two definitions of what cash is and indebtedness. And what the court said and held ultimately is that because the regulation does not define the terms cash and indebtedness, they were giving their ordinary meaning. And at the end of the day, what the court basically determined is that once you get cash, regardless of the source, and on page 10, the court said, whether cash is obtained from wages, a gift, or a loan makes no difference as to whether it qualifies as capital, so long as it's been lawfully acquired. So the court made very simple that this is pure cash. And once the person is giving that cash, obviously they can acquire an ownership stake in an EB-5 and make their investment. That it's not indebtedness as the government was arguing.
John, thank you. But we do have listeners who may need a little bit more of a simplification of all of this. So I thought perhaps I could give you a couple of examples and then you could tell me how the interpretation of Zhang would work. If, for example, somebody is taking a loan from a company and they get a company loan and the company gives the money directly, cash directly to the investor, how would that work under Zhang?
Okay, but I'm not trying to get technical, but when you say someone, you have to specify who it is, Mona, because if I am the investor and I take out a loan from my company.
Good point.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so when you say somebody, tell me who the somebody is.
So let's say it's the father. It's not the investor. So father takes money from a company. It may not be his company. It may be a friend's company, which he has no connection with. And then he gives that money to the investor to invest.
Okay. So under your hypothetical, the parent of the investor take out an unsecured loan through a company and the funds come from this company that he works for, et cetera. And he then gives this capital to his son to invest in EB-5. Under the Shang decision and previous, before the collateralization rule that we termed it, that was a proper investment because if you can source that the initial source of the funds is lawful, it doesn't matter whether it's unsecured and it doesn't have to be secured by any assets of the ultimate investor. So under that scenario, that would work. And in fact, that's what used to happen quite a bit before 2015, before the USCIS announced their shift in the analysis or in the adjudication. I think, as you know, there were hundreds of investors that used to capitalize EB-5 for decades. The bottom line is that the Shang decision puts us back to where we were before 2015 on the change on the policy. And obviously, a type of scenario like the one you just outlaid, Mona, is perfectly acceptable. By the same token, if the parents get an unsecured loan just from a bank, an institution could give you an unsecured loan, or partly secured by some assets that the parents own, and then they turn around and give it as a gift to the child for the child to be the EB-5 investor and put it in EB-5, that is perfectly acceptable.
I agree, John. It sounds acceptable, or at least in my mind, how EB-5 should work. But what really makes this decision important?
This decision was very important because it did win for the two plaintiffs that we represented, but we also did it as a class. And there was a class that got certified. Members of the class could get benefits from this decision. At the end, what the Shang decision said, and I think you could distribute it to your listeners, Mona, if necessary, that the decision applies to any investor who received an I-526 denial on or after June 23rd, 2009, that was solely based on the loan proceeds policy. So obviously, I think the majority of them come after the 2015 announcement. But if anybody got denied because they used cash that came from a loan's proceed that was not collateralized by assets of the investor, then they're part of the class and they could get benefits under this decision.
Yeah, thanks, John. I know many people were denied. Our clients who were denied, we ended up just refiling and coming up back into using a gift instead of a loan. But I have another question for you. Would any loan suffice? Do you remember there was a time when USCIS were looking at the fact, or it was actually Congress, that loans could only come from financial institutions or immediate family members and not from friends?
As long as you prove that it's lawful source. Obviously, if an individual gives you a loan, you're going to have to source that individual's acquisition of that capital. But as long as you can put that requirement, how you obtain that cash. And again, I go back to page 10 of the Shang decision. Whether cash is obtained from wages, a gift, or a loan makes no difference as to whether it qualifies as capital, so as long as it's been lawfully acquired. Why does it qualify as capital? Because cash is within the definition of capital. So it doesn't matter whether you get it from a personal loan from an individual, because there's no restrictions under the regulations, as far as I'm aware, that you could only get loans from individuals. For example, my two plaintiffs got the loan from their companies. Now, that doesn't mean that's not a commercial company. Those were entities that were engaged in business, but that was certainly not a commercial entity like a bank or any financial type of entity to extend those loans.
John, how many people are impacted by the decision? And how can they find out, or how would they be notified?
USCIS has not identified the number. USCIS sent out notification, and they have information on the website that if you believe you are within the class, that you could obviously contact USCIS and try to obtain the benefits under this decision. But there's a substantial number that took their money out and reinvested it by another mechanism, an outright gift from the parents, etc. Now, let's remember that some of these were actually loan proceeds as gift. The father would get the loan and then gift it to the child, but then they would say, wait a second, but it was not properly collateralized. So
the bottom line
to answer everybody's concerns is, what happens if I withdrew that investment and then I reinvested it later on? Can I now take advantage of this decision, and can I now go back to my earlier priority date? The answer is no. If you withdrew your money, you didn't sustain it. But if you sustained it and it's been sustained and you got denied based on this rule at any point between 2009 and the date of the decision, then you will be able to reopen your case and get an adjudication based on the proper interpretation of the regulation.
You know, John, what do you think is behind some of the misinterpretation of some of these regulations? Is it the fact that previously it was more of a standalone program, and then with the onset of the regional center, we started seeing different types of investors? Or what do you think?
Well, indebtedness had been litigated back in the 90s and 98 in Izumi in some of those cases, Mona, because a lot of people used to make promissory notes. And in the EB-5, you know, regional center context, they used to just give a promissory note, I will invest in the future. And that's what a promissory note is. That's what an indebtedness is. The relationship between the investor having to put a form of capital into the NCE. The government attempted to say in the litigation that this was just an interpretation of a rule that always existed. I think, obviously, because this comes even before the current administration, but I think the IPO, in my view, was already trying to restrict the pool of qualified investors by restricting some of the requirements. For example, here, they clearly violated the law. It's been proven by a district court and a circuit court of appeals in a precedent decision. But I think that was already an attempt by the USCIS to restrict the pool of qualified applicants and put hurdles, obviously, in the adjudication process by forcing people to either reinvest or an outright denial, forcing people to sue and take it to federal court.
Now, I happen to agree with you, but I'm also seeing another sort of angle that USCIS is taking, and which really is against the whole idea behind bringing in capital. I mean, the whole EB-5 program is to encourage capital to be invested in the United States, whether it's through domestic investment or foreign direct investment. And often we see this happening with EB-5 investments. But lately we have seen, and we've seen this since the middle of last year, there has been a misinterpretation of 8 CFR 204.6G, I believe, where USCIS are asking for the source of funds of non-EB-5 sources if it comes into the NCE. And we're seeing this mostly in the direct pooled or the direct context.
Well, I mean, obviously there's some language in that regulation when it defines all that they could be, you know, using or abusing the regulation, because I agree with you that as originally intended, what they wanted to find out is that the foreign capital, the EB-5 capital, is lawfully sourced. It's not illegal money from illegal activities like money laundering or drug dealing or what may. But I think this is part of a broader context, specifically under this administration, in restricting immigration, all forms of immigration, including EB-5, because by doing and taking this interpretation, what they're discouraging is U.S. capital funding or co-funding EB-5 investments. Because if I am a U.S. Investor, I could buy anything in the United States and I don't have to source it. I could buy condos, I could invest in corporations, I could invest in the stock market, and I could put $1 million in the stock market in NASDAQ, and I don't have to provide where I got that capital from. So in putting this incredible hurdle to non-EB-5 investors, because let's remember that you may have U.S. investors that want to put capital in EB-5 projects, but you also may have non-U.S. investors, mutual funds or whatever the case may be, who want to put this type of capital. Now, these type of investments happen every day in America. They could go buy buildings and real estate and stocks, and no one has to go through that due diligence of sourcing every cent and every penny for lawfulness. So I think this is a greater, again, attempt further restricting the availability and the pool of not only applicants, but actual projects. Because if this is carried to its logical conclusion, what it would mean is, what if I am a non-EB-5 investor, why would I put myself through that level of scrutiny?
Yeah.
Why would I be releasing all that data and all that evidence and my tax returns and financial statements and all these type of evidence to a government agency where I don't need to? So if the government is not challenged on this interpretation and taken to court, You know, and obviously, you know, Chang is a perfect example that you could win in federal court against the government. Then, in my view, Mona, what's going to lead is EV-5 projects will only be capitalized by EV-5 investors who have to go through that exercise in order to qualify for EB-5 anyways. Because if you're not an EB-5 investor, why would you want to go through that?
This brings me the question of, do you see an increase of litigation against USCIS, which we definitely do? Because right now, John, the stakes are so high. After seeing where we're at EB-5, we can see where projects have gone down. Look yourself, how many projects where EB-5 has been denied has actually just folded because EB-5 investors have pulled their money out before the project has matured, etc. And I don't know if USCIS really sees the myriad implications of a negative decision.
Again, I may be a little cynical in this sense that I don't think immigration cares.
Cynical, John?
Yeah. I don't think they care. My personal view is that, you know, when you have denials, for example, that are undergoing in some project where the SEC got in and the investors are victims and they're trying to restructure it and immigration is taking adverse decisions and denying I-829 petitions and so forth, when they're terminating regional centers where they got tainted projects and untainted projects and trying to bring every project, whether tainted or untainted, down. So I don't think immigration is too concerned about the overall policy implications. Obviously, that involves, to me, a two-step process. One is when you have incorrect decisions, the law allows you to file these lawsuits, and sometimes they may be timely, but the only way to put a check on a runaway agency is to sue them and hold them accountable.
But then do we go to the AAO? Because some lawyers still believe of going to the AAO, or would you go directly to the federal court?
There's a clear precedent. When you sue on a denial under the Administrative Procedures Act, you have to have a final decision. So, for example, can I sue on an I-526 that hasn't been denied yet that I think is going to be denied? No, because I don't have a final decision. But there's clear Supreme Court precedent that says that if the denial from the agency, for example, let's take the I-526 denial from USCIS, that doesn't lead to a direct appeal that stays the underlying decision, like an AO appeal, that I don't have to go to the AO. I could simply go to federal court. Now, the decision whether to do a motion to reopen, reconsider, on file in federal court, it's based on the record. Because when you file a lawsuit on an I-526 denial, the administrative record is your universe. You cannot add to it generally. You could do some discovery in certain limited circumstances, but that is your universe. So if your universe is not as good as it could be, then maybe a motion to reopen, reconsider an AO appeal may be warranted. Obviously, in an AO appeal, you will have less ability to add additional evidence. So in our view, obviously, filing an AO appeal is generally not required. It's a tactical decision. The other thing that needs to be taken into account is the following. If you get a denial, like, for example, these denials, we did not go to the AO. And had they gone to the AO could have fixed the denial and denied it on something else that would have made it harder to file a lawsuit. Because when you have a decision and it's based, for example, in this, the loan proceeds collateralization rule, I don't have to wait for the AO to define it or add another ground. I went to court, federal court, right away. And obviously, despite the passage of time, because it took about 5 years through the whole process to sort out, but we were successful at the first instance and the second instance.
I think that's a great point, John, that we need to make sure that the record is as complete as possible before we even consider going to federal court.
Correct.
John, we're also seeing a lot of increased litigation against USCIS for the delays. And here, I really want to ask your opinion, because many a time we see that perhaps a mandamus is not the correct way to go forward. What's your opinion on this?
The first thing I'll say is that a mandamus will only get you a decision, whether an approval or a denial. So,
or, you know, an RFE.
Well, but it's to get an ultimate decision. I mean, I have in every mandamus that I file, and I file hundreds in the EB-5 context, and in other contexts, by the way, in other immigration procedures, like an adjustment of status. So the RFE is part of getting that decision. So in a lot of the mandamus that I file, we get an RFE, respond to the RFE, then we negotiate with the government for the final decision. And then once we have the final decision, we dismiss the mandamus.
But John, last year, for example, the decisions which came in, the people who actually, there were very few people who got their decisions, but 96%, I believe, of them were ones which came from mandamus.
Correct. I don't know the statistics. I could tell you that virtually, well, all the cases where I file a mandamus, either I got an RFE or an OID, we responded, and then there was a final decision. Like I said, a mandamus only guarantees you a decision, not an approval. So you got to know your record before you file the mandamus. You have to know that it's a good record to be approvable. And you got to expect that you may get a notice of intent to deny or a request for evidence, depending on how long it's been pending. I have been privy to litigation in the mandamus and APA context for unreasonable delays, where the government has filed motions to dismiss. I've been privy to some of those decisions where the lawyers have successfully defended motions to dismiss and continue with the mandamus. Another thing that a lot of people are worried is, well, if I file a mandamus where they retaliate, it technically would be inappropriate to retaliate, but you will get a decision. And sometimes people believe that I got a nastier or a worse decision by suing.
Do you think that happens?
I don't think so. My view has always been that you're going to get whatever decision you're going to get. And the more time you give the government to mull over a decision, the worse that it could be for the investor. In addition to, you know, under COVID, the passage of time may not have a beneficial effect on some projects, and some projects may and some projects may not. So you have to take all of these things into consideration to make a proper determination of when to file a lawsuit for an unreasonable delay in the form of APA and or mandamus.
Yeah, but you do see that this area is only going to increase in litigation, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, the new processing times, I think, for I-9 is something like 19 years.
Yes, we saw that. And we just laughed. We thought, is this a joke?
Correct. I mean, I think that, I'll be honest with you, because I've been litigating in the mandamus context for a long time. There was an ombudsman report many years ago that said that basically the processing times do not have a lot of substance, meaning they're just at best an estimate. Every time they put a fee on a form, it tells you how long they think it's going to take to adjudicate that application. So if you look at what was put in the Federal Register for I-9s and I-526s based on the fee, on the amount of time it would take to adjudicate, it has absolutely no resemblance to the current processing times, who are absolutely a joke. And I think actually, you know, there's many people that feel that the processing times are put there in order to defend mandamus, saying, see, you're just in the waiting line. But I think that it's so ridiculous now that I don't see a federal court really truly believing that you have to wait 19 years before your petition's approved.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is just totally unreasonable. And they just keep arbitrarily changing the dates in the register.
Completely agree. What I will say, though, is, you know, some people feel and get more aggressive. I generally think that, you know, waiting around 2 years, which is, you know, in the old days, a two-year adjudication was reasonable. It still may be reasonable to wait before filing a mandamus. On the shorter end, I've seen some litigation going as quickly as 6 months pending, but I think that's a little bit aggressive. And, you know, like anything, the more you litigate, the more you spend money. I mean, fighting the government is not an inexpensive proposition.
No, it's not. And any advice to people who may be thinking of mandamus this year, given the fact that USCIS also suffered from delays with COVID and working remotely, etc.? Should we take that into consideration?
To be honest with you, the only consideration that I would think is, how long has your petition been pending? What's in the record? And does the record support an approval? And does the current state of the project, if you get an RFE or a notice of intent to deny where you could respond and successfully respond, to me, those should be the considerations of whether you file a mandamus or not.
I think that's an excellent piece of advice, because we often see this, that people do not look at the state of the project or if they are in the position to be able to answer an RFE should it be given. John, thank you. As usual, great words of wisdom. And I'm pretty sure that we will have you back on again with another great decision.
Yeah, I agree, Mona. I hope so, because whenever John is on, typically that means it's good news for the rest of us.
Well, I will welcome the opportunity. Like I said, I think that litigation, whether to fix an unreasonable delay in your petition or to curb agency abuse and to put a check, really, on agency abuse and obtain proper adjudications and setting what the law really says, is critical. It has to be part of the arsenal. It has to be part of the calculation in EB-5 and immigration, really, going forward. So thank you for highlighting it, Mona, and a great job in, obviously, this podcast that you do.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.